This is a portion from my Leviticus Numbers commentary published by Zondervan, NIV Application Commentary Series. It's pages 305 to 3. Well, I'm not going to go as far as 314. I'll make it a little shorter than that. The biblical laws do not comprehensively specify every detail of the ways we should think and act. Rather, they provide illustrations that reveal the character and values of the divine lawgiver, thereby establishing the constitution or charter of covenant life with him. Even the Ten Commandments are only examples, illustrations of the main areas of moral law. Are Christians expected to keep any of the biblical laws, or are there any from which we could gain benefit by voluntarily observing them? We are not talking about a legalistic, works-oriented approach to salvation, but about people who are already saved, enjoying fuller new covenant life and service by following divine guidance and thereby revealing God's character to others. For many centuries, Christians have followed a simplistic approach. The early church fathers, I'm quoting here, the early church fathers dealt with Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and chunks of Exodus very simply. We keep the Ten Commandments, and the rest of the law and commandments do not apply to Christians. Now, see, I'm reading from a non-SDA author, but this is the idea that many SDAs have. One might ask how they squared that with what Jesus himself had to say about Torah, that he did not come to change a single jot or tittle of it. Further, when asked what were the greatest of the commandments, Jesus gives two, neither of which comes from the ten. Rather, one is from Deuteronomy and the other is from Leviticus. Nevertheless, the church fathers deemed those extra 603 laws to be superfluous. There were those who thought they should be removed from the Christian canon entirely, but fortunately, they did not prevail. If many Christians had their way, there would be no Leviticus. Yes, nothing for me to write on. For the purpose of determining if or how various kinds of Old Testament laws apply today, it is traditional for Christians to divide them into categories, such as the following. First, moral laws. And what I'm saying now is the standard view. This is not what I necessarily believe, and then we're going to tweak that, okay? So this is what is generally held. Moral laws, consisting of the Ten Commandments, which express timeless and universal principles governing relationships with God and other human beings. I don't necessarily disagree with that, but we're going to clarify it a little bit more. Is that better if I do that? Okay. As I said, we'll tweak it. Ritual laws is the second category that served as types or shadows until they met their fulfillment at the cross. Civil laws, applicable. I've got to talk to my mother about this. She made my ears. Okay. Thank you. All right. Civil laws applicable only under the Israelite theocratic government. Four is health laws that have ongoing value because human bodies function the same today as they did in ancient times. While such categories have some validity and usefulness, the understanding of them as just summarized needs major nuancing and qualification. Careful examination leads to a paradigm shift and opens up a treasure trove of practical guidance for daily living. To begin with, we should recognize that the Bible does not delineate categories such as those stated above. They are more recent analytical constructs. Biblical law does not even make the sharp distinction between religious and secular categories to which we are so accustomed and which Adventists will observe this evening after the sun goes down. Since every aspect of life as the people of God came under his jurisdiction, laws belonging to what we would classify as the religious and secular domains often appear together. For example, the so-called religious laws of Exodus 22 and so on, 23, appear in contexts primarily relating to secular life. The remarkably diverse mixture of laws in Leviticus 19 gives the impression that distinctions between religious and secular are largely irrelevant. What is important is that God's people keep all of his commandments. In the ancient Near East, this holistic approach to life under God is unique to Israel. Only in biblical law collections, as Shalom Paul has pointed out in his studies in the Book of the Covenant, are moral exhortations and religious injunctions combined with legal prescriptions. Elsewhere, these three distinct spheres are found in separate independent collections. The next few paragraphs consider each of the four categories mentioned above. First, moral law expresses principles that modern people would regard as either as religious, that is the first four of the Ten Commandments regarding responsibilities primarily to God, or secular, that is the last six of the Ten Commandments covering responsibilities primarily to human beings. two points should be clarified regarding moral law. First, any command that God requires a given group of people to obey could be regarded as moral law for them in the broad sense that it is relevant to their divine human relationship. Second, while the Ten Commandments are towering expressions of timeless universal moral law, they are not the only moral laws in the Bible. Exodus 23 verse 9, for example, contains another one. Do not oppress an alien. This works out part of the overarching principle of love for fellow human beings, on which the last six of the Ten Commandments are also based. Another example is Leviticus 19:11, where the comprehensive commandment against lying is found. The ninth commandment of the Ten Commandments is against false witness. It's not against lying. Now, it includes and it overlaps with lying, but there are kinds of lying which are not false witness. The comprehensive commandment against lying is outside the Ten Commandments, Leviticus 19:11. And we could mention other laws with regard to sexuality, homosexuality, and so on, that are outside the Ten Commandments. Ritual law, moving on to the next category, regulates a ritual system by means of which human beings interact with entities that are ordinarily inaccessible to the human domain, to the material domain, such as God, by offering sacrifices, for example. And another kind of thing that you can interact with in sacrifices are ritual impurities that you can remove through purification. For example, the goat for Azazel, a so-called scapegoat, is loaded. He's a tote goat full of loaded with all of this toxic waste, and he goes off and dumps it in Satan's territory. Get a load of this. Gives it to Azazel. See, that's interacting with ritual impurities, which you can't see, but they're there. The Old Testament ritual laws that were required to be carried out at the Israelite sanctuary or temple, where the Aaronite priests officiated, can no longer apply because this institution is gone. Laws having to do with regulation and treatment of ritual impurities to keep them from contacting the holy sphere of the earthly sanctuary with its resident divine presence are also obsolete for the same reason. The sanctuary no longer exists. Since the death, resurrection, and ascension of Christ, Christian worship is focused towards God's temple in heaven, where Christ is being ministering. Nevertheless, the Old Testament ritual laws teach us much about the nature and character of God and mankind, the dynamics of divine-human interaction, and God's plan of salvation through Christ. So we do not need to have deacons and deaconesses standing at the door when we have communion or the Lord's Supper, asking very, very personal questions of people. What were you doing last night? And things like that. And what time of the month is it before you can partake of the emblems? See, that is... You get my drift? Okay, that's passé because Christ's ministry is in heaven. We don't have the resident Shekinah on earth. We call this a sanctuary, but in a very, very different sense. The Israelite sanctuary was not a place for people to come into the church. It was a place for them to be barred from. They have to stay outside because God's resident presence is really there. So we believe He's here with us through His Spirit, but He's ministering in heaven. Okay, now, what about the ritual of circumcision, which originated long before the Israelite sanctuary, which was constructed and was never dependent upon its function? However, this requirement was removed for Gentile Christians when the new covenant was transformed from a covenant of Israelite election, as Jeremiah originally promised, to a universal covenant without ethnic boundaries. So the New Testament removes that, because that's the way that the wall is broken down between Jews and Gentiles, because Christ's gospel is now universal. And as I look around this room, I see quite a few people, including myself, if I look in something, yeah, there I am, that are not descended from the Jewish people. Now, why are we here? Because that wall was broken down. Praise the Lord for that. Civil law. What about civil law? Can embody and exemplify timeless moral or ethical principles within the ancient Israelite context. Consider, for example, the following civil law from the covenant code of Exodus 21-23. Anyone who strikes a man and kills him shall surely be put to death. Exodus 21:12. Now this contextualizes the sixth of the Ten Commandments, which reads, "You shall not murder." There are two basic differences between the two laws. First, the civil law is narrower in scope, limited to striking that results in death. But this is still a timeless principle. Second, the civil law attaches a penalty, namely capital punishment, that would be administered by the Israelite system of jurisprudence within the theocratic covenant community. We can no longer count on this court system to enforce the law in this way, because the system no longer exists. So we have found that the law contains both ongoing and temporary elements. If we simplistically dismiss it as a civil or Mosaic law, and therefore no longer applicable, we miss the timeless moral element. You must not hit a person in such a way that he or she dies. You really shouldn't do that. It's not cool. A modern court in any country would undoubtedly agree that such striking is a crime, although it may or may not impose the same penalty. And we have big debates about capital punishment and so on. Now, is it good that we are not living in a theocracy? Well, there have been a lot of pseudo-theocracies. When God was living with his resident Shekinah there, he could control things in all kinds of ways. But modern people, when they try, or people since then, who have tried to establish theocracies, it ends up like the Taliban. And there have been attempts, so-called Christian attempts, the Puritans and so on. And every time it has gruesome results because you don't have the resident Shekinah there to control things. Human beings are not capable of that. We could talk a lot about jihad, but that's another part of my commentary that you'll just have to read there. All right. In civil laws, timeless principles come to us in various layers of cultural garb. When we get below the specifics to the underlying dynamics, we can find helpful guidelines to clothe in modern dress. For example, if a man uncovers a pit or digs one and fails to cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit must pay for the loss. He must pay its owner, and the dead animal will be his. Although this could literally apply today, most of us do not have oxen or donkeys. What we have are cars and trucks, with regard to which the principle applies. I actually drive a Cougar. We are liable for damage to the property of other people resulting from our neglect. In our community, we have two dogs, two cats, and a guinea pig, and a duck and a chicken. Our neighbors have llamas, a bull calf. We don't have oxen or donkeys, but you see, the principle applies. And God only refers to an oxen or a donkey, but Israelites had other animals too. They had camels and other things. But he just uses these as examples, and we're supposed to use the gray matter between these two ears and figure out that there are also other ways that this timeless principle can apply, which relates to the eighth commandment, respect somebody else's property. Some civil laws no longer apply simply because we lack the social institutions they were designed to regulate. For example, servitude. Although, of course, today there can be other kinds of servitude and abuse of workers. And people can be in debt slavery for life. And the whole generation now is in debt servitude to credit card companies. Okay, so there are principles that apply, but it's not exactly the same. And there's ancestral land tenure. However, by studying these laws in light of their cultural context, we can still learn valuable principles of justice and mercy to protect those who are socially and economically disadvantaged. For example, even when your workers are completely dependent upon you and under your control, do not rule over them ruthlessly, but fear your God. Regarding health law, in connection with Leviticus 11, we found that Pentateuchal laws for which we recognize health implications are consistently formulated with motivations other than health. God was concerned for the health of his people, but he bestowed this benefit holistically as a blessing that would come from observing all his commands. In other words, you cannot go anywhere in the Pentateuch. If you find a case, bring it to my attention. I've never seen it. There is not one case in the Pentateuch, the Torah, the five books of Moses, where a health motivation is given for following a particular law. You know, if you do this law, then some aspect of your health will do well. You know, your right bicep will do better, or you know, whatever. You never find that. It's not like modern health how-to kind of books. All you have is, if you keep all my commands, then you will prosper and be in health. None of the diseases of the Egyptians will come upon you. So it's not a cafeteria-style kind of thing where you pick and choose. You have everything, and then God gives you health as a blessing, you see? Which makes perfect sense, because if you are if you're a vegetarian and if you don't smoke or drink, then you could have other health problems. You know who was a vegetarian, didn't smoke or drink? Adolf Hitler. Now, he would have been a much better Adventist in those terms than Eisenhower or Churchill, who smoked like fish and drank like, smoked like chimneys and drank like fish. In fact, I've even heard that Hitler's cook was an Adventist, probably because he was vegetarian. So you see, you can have all kinds of other things going wrong in your life, and you're not going to end up living to a ripe old age, and he didn't. I'm using it a very extreme example. So God says, obey all my laws and you will be blessed. Okay, I think you see the point. Now we're in a better position to grapple with the question of whether the prohibition in Leviticus 17, 10 to 14 against eating meat with blood still applies. Okay, so let's use this as a particular example. Is this a moral, ritual, civil, or health law? The fact that eating meat with blood has to do with diet implies that health could be involved. And modern science confirms that blood carries disease. This could be reason enough to abstain from meat with blood. However, in Leviticus 17:11, the Lord's reason for the prohibition is, "For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have assigned it to you on the altar to ransom your lives, for it is the blood that ransoms by means of life." Mention of the altar indicates a ritual element in the law. Indeed, because God assigned the blood of sacrificable animals for application on his altar, the Israelites were not permitted either to offer their sacrifices anywhere else or to eat the blood of well-being offerings. But does this mean that the law has no application now that the ritual system is gone? So we're dealing with a particularly interesting and problematic case. It's a test case now that we have found the four different kinds of categories and nuanced them a bit. In verse 11 of Leviticus 17, the most basic reason for the prohibition is that the blood represents life. This is why God selected the blood of sacrificable animals for the function of ransom. Even where ransom through animal sacrifice did not apply, as in the case of a non-sacrificable game animal, like a deer, the Israelites were forbidden to eat meat with blood, because the blood of any animal represented its life. That this was the basic reason is confirmed by Genesis 9, where the Lord first allowed human beings to eat meat just after the flood, but withheld permission to eat meat with its lifeblood still in it. The next two verses read, "As and for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal. And from each man, too, I will demand an accounting for the life of his fellow man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made man." The prohibitions of blood and of murder are both based on the timeless moral principle of respect for God-given life that is expressed in the sixth of the Ten Commandments. So although the blood prohibition in Leviticus 17 has health and ritual implications, it is more fundamentally a moral law. This explains several pieces of biblical data. First, in Genesis 9, God gave the prohibition to Noah for the entire human race before the Israelite nation and its ritual worship system existed. Second, in Ezekiel 33:25-26, eating meat with blood is listed with moral faults such as murder, idolatry, and adultery. Three, although the early Christian council in Jerusalem recognized that the ceremonial requirement of circumcision was non-binding upon Gentile Christians, the prohibition of eating meat with blood was included in the bottom line lifestyle requirements that were laid upon Gentile Christians, among other tests of fellowship. Notice that Acts 15 refers to the Old Testament, where the only biblical requirement for preventing ingestion of blood along with meat is to drain it out at the time of slaughter. Although it's impossible to remove every bit of blood in this manner, just as draining the oil out of a car leaves a small amount of oil lining parts of the engine, basic drainage fulfills the divine command. If this is done, as is often the case in modern butchering, it's not necessary for Christians to follow additional traditional practices of salting and roasting to get more blood out. Now, that was just an example, but can we boil this entire discussion down into a simple, single rule of thumb to determine whether the Bible intends for Christians to keep a given Old Testament law? Now, here is my attempt, and this is how the sentence goes. A law should be kept, so the default is that it should be kept, to the extent, and only to the extent, that its principle can be applied, unless the New Testament removes the reason for its application. That's it. I'll read it again. A law should be kept to the extent that its principle can be applied, unless the New Testament removes the reason for its application. Thus, I'm in basic agreement with Gordon Wenham. He's a scholar in England. He's not an Adventist. When he concluded that, quote, "the principles underlying the OT are valid and authoritative for the Christian, but the particular applications found in the Old Testament may not be." So you can see, for example, if God tells you in Deuteronomy, if you have a flat roof, make a parapet around so people don't fall off. Well, do you have a flat roof at home? Can that apply? Absolutely. I don't have a flat roof, but Sarah has a balcony outside and it has a little railing so people won't fall off and get hurt. The principle of keeping people from getting hurt on your property could apply to a crack in the sidewalk or all kinds of other things, right? And it makes perfect sense. And these laws are valuable and very helpful for us to be safe, to get along with each other, to protect each other and ourselves. And we neglect, and we have neglected, wholesale neglected, these laws that God has given us to our detriment. We have lost a tremendous amount because we've said, that's just a civil law. It's Mosaic. Therefore, it doesn't apply. And we've missed all this wonderful, valuable instruction. If we read those and then we think about the principle that's behind them and underneath them, then we're going to gain a tremendous amount. Some laws, of course, Deuteronomy 25, 5 to 10, I'm going to quit on this one. If two brothers dwell together on an undivided estate, they live together, that is, and one of them dies, leaving his widow childless, then the other one is to take her in marriage, you see. Now, you can't just thump the Bible and say, just read and do. Right? Some people do it. Just read and do. I always say, okay, that's fine, cool. Deuteronomy 25, 5 to 10, read it, do. We need massive reform. We need to reinstitute brother-in-law marriage, you know, levirate marriage. And it doesn't say that he may not already have a wife. So, okay, it gets very, very complicated. But what does Paul say to Timothy? He says, you need to be rightly dividing or analyzing the word of truth. There is an intermediate stage between read and do, and it's called think. Read, think, and then do. You look for the principle that's timeless, then you apply that. And with that, I will sit down, since my paper is not timeless.